This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. While all the other members of Connecticut's congressional delegation voted against it, Jim Himes has been a strong supporter of fast-track trade authority, which has allowed the president to negotiate with 11 other Pacific nations on trade. Critics say this deal is a giveaway to big corporations, won't protect American jobs, and is being negotiated away from public scrutiny. But Himes and the president say the opportunity in this deal is huge, allowing the U.S. to open up new markets for its products, allowing the U.S. to get ahead of China in regulating Pacific trade and opening new markets for our products. Today, Where We Live, a conversation with Jim Himes and an opportunity for you to ask questions at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can email us wherewelive@wnpr.org. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We're hoping to have Jim Himes in a studio very soon, but for now he joins us by phone. Just a few technical issues to work out. But good morning to you, Congressman. Thanks so much for calling us in.
Good morning, John. Delighted to be with you.
And hopefully we'll be able to clean up your line and get you sounding a little bit better soon. But it is good of you to join us, and we'll be getting to some calls and questions from our audience in just a few minutes. Before we get into some of the questions about trade that I have for you that I know a lot of our listeners have, I want to extend our condolences to you and to the family of Kevin Sutherland. He was a former intern of yours, and we learned that he was stabbed to death in a D.C. metro station over the weekend. What can you tell us about this, and what can you tell us about Kevin?
Yeah, John, it was just a brutal tragedy. I learned about it yesterday morning. Kevin was a wonderful, wonderful young man who I had gotten to know when I first started running for Congress, 8 years ago, and he'd been an intern and on my staff and campaign and official side and everything, and recent graduate of American University, just completely dedicated to politics. He's got a very political family. His father is very, very involved in Fairfield County Democratic politics. And, yeah, we learned yesterday, just shockingly, that at something like 1:30 in the afternoon, one stop from Union Station in downtown D.C., he was murdered by an individual that they are still looking for, who apparently had been arrested the day before and released. And so there's an awful lot of people down here who knew Kevin and really loved the guy, who are obviously just stunned by what happened. But thank you for your condolences.
We're talking with Jim Himes. He's a congressman, of course, who represents Fairfield County in Connecticut. And we've got a lot to talk to him about around trade and other issues. But, of course, we're hearing this news about a former intern of his from Connecticut, who was tragically killed over the weekend. I should ask you, Jim Himes, as I think that we're now able to reestablish you on a studio line as opposed to the crackly phone line you've just been on. Are you there, Congressman?
Yeah, I'm here.
Excellent. Very, very good. A lot of people look at people in your job as people who are out there by themselves on camera a lot, and maybe we don't understand exactly what goes into the office that is behind you. When we hear about an intern being in the news for obviously such terrible reasons, it allows, I think, you and many of the rest of us to take a slightly closer look at the work that is done behind the scenes for you and your colleagues in Washington. Can you talk about that, about the work that goes in behind the scenes, these interns, these young people who are getting into politics perhaps for the first time and helping to drive American policy as much perhaps as the people who are out in front like yourself?
Sure. No, I mean, it's a really remarkable ecosystem of young people, you know, down in D.C. and in members of Congress's and senators' district office. Again, we're talking largely about people who are sort of between the ages of 20 and 30, because, you know, these are not very well-paying jobs if they pay at all. Internships, of course, by and large, don't pay. But they attract, you know, kids like Kevin who are very, very interested in our political process. And yeah, you know, what people sometimes don't see in a congressional office is that, you know, 9 to 5, in district, we are helping people get passports because they leave tomorrow morning for a vacation and they didn't realize their passport was expired. Veterans who are having trouble with the VA. You know, we literally get dozens and dozens of these cases coming in the door every single week. And it takes a really competent staff, largely comprised of these very enthusiastic, underpaid young people, to make these federal bureaucracies and other groups responsive to constituents. You know, that's a sort of typical in-district thing. And in Washington, of course, you know, bills don't write themselves, and so you've got a lot of young people You know, helping somebody like me. You know, one of the interesting things about this job is, you know, 9 to 10 will be the Iran negotiations. 10 to 11 will be trade and Vietnamese is your environmental regulations. And then 11 to 12 will be Medicare and long-term viability there. And then, you know, you know, nobody's mind is quite so nimble that they can get all that down. And therefore having people who, you know, kind of are behind you doing a lot of research, giving you the kind of information, helping you think through things is really critical. And Kevin, gosh, he probably played more than his fair share of those roles in my operation. So again, just very, very sad about what happened.
We're talking with Jim Himes. We're going to get to some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266 in just a moment. He joins us today from the studios of WSHU, our friends in Fairfield County, where, of course, he represents the state of Connecticut. You have voted to support the trade authority that the president is negotiating with 11 other Pacific nations. This is something that you broke with your other colleagues in the Connecticut delegation on. As I said in the introduction, there's been a lot of criticism about this Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, as it's called, and the fast-track authority that would allow the president to essentially negotiate this without Congress changing anything around the trade deal that is negotiated. A lot of critics of this deal have said that it's been out of the public eye, that the public doesn't know enough about it. There have been some who've criticized it as a giveaway to big corporations. Some say that it will cost American jobs. You see this as a big opportunity. I guess I'm wondering if you can just lay out broadly your support for this deal and for the authority that you've given the president.
Sure, sure. So let's start with that, what's known as Trade Promotion Authority, TPA, what sometimes people call fast track, because that is what, in fact, I did break with not just my colleagues in Connecticut, but pretty much around New England. 28 House Democrats supported the president in his request for this authority. And what this authority is, it's been around for, you know, 60, 70 years. Basically, every president since FDR has had some version of this Trade Promotion Authority, which basically says the president can go out and negotiate a trade deal, you know, one-on-one with one or other countries, and then bring it back to the Congress. Congress can debate it, but then Congress, as part of this deal, votes up or down, meaning we go yay or nay on whatever treaty is proposed to us. That obviously is a mechanism that allows the president to negotiate without the fear that after, you know, the unbelievably complex negotiations with 11 other countries, that it comes back to Washington and now you have 535 members of Congress renegotiating that deal through the amendment process. That's the logic. I thought that we ought to have an opportunity to look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership and vote it up or down. I didn't think it was appropriate to take this one president and say, sorry, Mr. President, despite the fact that other presidents have had this authority, we're not giving it to you. And this points us, of course, John, to part two of the discussion, which is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And some of the criticisms that you leveled, I think, are somewhat valid, meaning like the Iran deal, which is being negotiated right now, like collective bargaining, like the bargaining you do when you buy a house. You're not having this negotiation in the open. It is happening behind closed doors, and that's a pretty uncomfortable thing. Or you understand why it is. That's the way negotiations tend to happen. But it's a little bit uncomfortable because people, of course, not knowing what's in there, tend to fear the worst. And so you hear this language that this is going to, you know, for example, the falsehood that this is going to set up tribunals that require us to change our law, which is very simply a falsehood. But when it comes right down to it, John, here's why I supported it. Connecticut is an exporting state. We export billions and billions of dollars every single year. My congressional district, the fourth, is the most dense exporting part of Connecticut. And in the big picture here, we are going to succeed as a country. Prosperity will come back and the middle class will thrive because we engage the world, because we increase those exports. By the way, export jobs being much higher paying than non-export jobs. It's that kind of engagement that is going to help grow our economy in a way that is satisfying. We can't turn our back on the world and say, sorry, we're not going to trade. And so that's why I came out where I did in terms of supporting the president's request for what people call the fast track.
I'd like you to listen to just a little bit of tape we have from our colleague Bill Curry. He, of course, is a former Clinton staffer. He was twice the nominee for governor of Connecticut on the Democratic side. He's a regular contributor to us and also to Salon. And he was on recently on our program talking about the TPP. Let's listen.
There isn't any single aspect of our social contract or of the governance of commerce which can't be leached out of the democracy and into a kind of star chamber, a much less public, much less democratic, non-due process kind of corporate-dominated decision-making. And this is really the heart of the TPP. It's not about trade among nations. It's about the relationship of global corporations to all democracies.
I'm wondering if you can just respond to what Bill Curry had to say there, because a lot of our conversation on that day on our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, was about the transparency aspect of this. And at the end, who was going to be allowed in the room to negotiate this trade deal, whether or not it was indeed the president and other elected officials of the United States, or whether it was big corporations with very different interests in mind.
Yeah, well, let's take that first point, which is a more narrow point. Who's doing the negotiation and how is that happening? And then let's go to the broader characterization that Bill does of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. First of all, it is the United States Trade Representative and his staff that are negotiating this deal. And there's been a lot of concern. People have said we don't know what's in it. Around that staff are a whole bunch of committees made up of corporate representatives, made up of environmental representatives, made up of the presidents of all of the country's major labor unions who have access to the TPP draft and who advise the USTR on that negotiation. By the way, every member of Congress also has access to the negotiating text. I've read it myself. And so, you know, there is some transparency there, acknowledging, of course, that this is an ongoing negotiation that is happening behind closed doors. And that's a pretty uncomfortable thing, right? Because now I have to respond to Bill Curry's charge that this is some star chamber, as he puts it, and that it's there for the benefit of the multinational corporations. It's hard to do that when you're sort of prohibited from saying, here's exactly what is in TPP. But let me give you a taste of it. The TPP is actually not about corporations. It is about regulated trade with countries like Vietnam and Malaysia, whereby the TPP will say to Vietnam, Vietnam, you, in order to be part of this trade agreement, must permit labor unions, independent labor unions, to grow up in your country. That's currently illegal in Vietnam. It will say to Malaysia, if you want to be part of this agreement and have access to 40% of the global economy, you are going to need to achieve these environmental standards, whether it's, you know, no longer wiping out, you know, old growth rainforests or whatever it might be, and hold them to account with certain mechanisms to actually do that. That's a key part of this that is actually a really good opportunity to raise the quality of environmental standards and labor standards and other standards around a region that is not known for those things. Secondarily, I've read the TPP. There are pages in there of what Japan is willing to do to reduce the non-tariff barriers to our auto exports to Japan. Right now, our auto market share in Japan is negligible. It's less than 1%. They are undertaking to reduce a lot of the barriers that make it so. So again, it's an opportunity for expanded exports. And then finally, and I think this is what Bill is alluding to, and I respectfully disagree, there is a mechanism that has attracted a lot of attention called the Investor-State Dispute Resolution Mechanism. Boy, I'll tell you, we'll go to sleep quickly on this topic. But bottom line is it doesn't, as Bill suggests, reach into every aspect of our legal code. It basically says that if a U.S. investor in Malaysia, say, has their plants confiscated or is in some way treated in an arbitrary or discriminatory fashion, that is to say, in a way that is different from the way a Malaysian investor is treated, there is an arbitration panel that is set up to rule whether or not that U.S. Investor was treated in arbitrary or discriminatory fashion. It does not permit, and this has been just one of the unfortunate bits of misinformation out there. It does not permit a change in U.S. law. These dispute resolution mechanisms are limited to imposing money damages if, in fact, these panels find that there has been discriminatory or arbitrary behavior.
But can you explain what discriminatory or arbitrary behavior might mean? I mean, one person's discriminatory might be very different than somebody else's. And I can imagine a corporation expecting that certain environmental regulations, say, are discriminatory against their ability to make money or do business in the way they see fit. I mean, how do we arrive at what arbitrary and discriminatory is?
Because you're not comparing it to what an investor may say is the perfect regulatory regime. In other words, some investor can't go into Malaysia and say, hey, I disagree with these, environmental protections you've put in place. What an investor would need to do to bring a case would need to say to Malaysia, just in this example that we're using here, you are treating me as a foreign investor differently than you are treating a Malaysian investor. So, for example, if let's just imagine a car manufacturing plant. This is actually a pretty good example. Example, right? If Japanese automobiles were subject to less rigorous environmental standards or were expedited in their licensing processes much faster than U.S. autos in Japan, that would be cause for the U.S. automakers to say, hey, Japan, you're treating me differently than you're treating your domestic producers. And you sort of see the reason for that. If you're going to, in fact, have a free trade area, countries shouldn't be allowed to favor their domestic manufacturers at the expense of foreign investors. If you want to do that, that's fine. Just you don't do that in the context of a free trade agreement. So again, it doesn't allow an investor to say, I don't like Malaysia, your environmental regulations. It just gives them a recourse if they are being treated differently than other investors.
If you have a question for Jim Himes, you can call us at 860-275-7266 as we talk about the Trans-Pacific trade deal. He joins us today from a studio at WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Let's go to Tony, who's calling from Manchester. Hi there, Tony. You're on Where We Live.
Yes. Hi, John. Representative Himes. Glad you're joining us. Many of my points have been already raised by you in conversation, so I've been trying to regroup my thoughts, and it boils down to I don't trust anything that is in secret, and I trust very little that's coming out of Congress these days. My particular parent union, the AFL-CIO, is calling for publication of these negotiations. They want it to be out of the dark. I do not believe you when you say that the interests of the workers and the environment are being safeguarded. This is all about the corporations. This is to allow the third worlding of this country, at the expense of unions, at the expense of workers, just so that corporations can spread worldwide.
And Tony, thank you very much for that. And I'll let Jim Himes respond.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the comment, Tony. Look, I agree with part of what you said and disagree with another part. First of all, the part I agree with it is uncomfortable that these negotiations are happening behind closed doors. It means that I've been able to read them. That is to say, the draft agreement. You know, I know what Japan is saying they will do with respect to allowing our auto imports. And by the way, you know, the UAW, the United Auto Workers, are part of the AFL-CIO. And I promise you, if we succeed in getting, you know, U.S. auto market share in Japan from 0.5% to 10%, that's huge for the UAW and for American workers generally. But it's hard to talk about that, of course, if these negotiations happen behind closed doors. Why are they happening behind closed doors? I wish they weren't. I wouldn't be in the position of actually having to sort of explain something that, because it's uncertain, people, you know, fear it and have some anxiety if it were, in fact, public. But collective bargaining negotiations that the AFL-CIO enters into all the time, those happen behind closed doors. The current Iran negotiations, which will be much in the paper this week, are happening behind closed doors. Nobody seems to raise an objection to that, and that's because you understand that if you want people to stretch, if you want people to make offers that allow for compromise to be reached, you know, it's hard to do that when people, the outside world, is breathing down your shoulders. And again, that's why the AFL-CIO negotiates their collective bargaining agreements behind closed doors. But nonetheless, it is uncomfortable. Look, bottom line, over time, in the last 50 years in this country, lots of manufacturing jobs have left this country. And that's a terrible tragedy that has hollowed out communities like Bridgeport throughout the Midwest and elsewhere. Those jobs left because business owners looked at Shenzhen, China, where, by the way, we don't have a trade agreement, or other locales and said, look, I can pay $2 an hour there versus $20 an hour in Cincinnati or in Bridgeport. And they upped and they moved those factories. And that's a very profoundly damaging thing. But that happened inside and outside of trade agreements. And frankly, that kind of destruction of our manufacturing base has been going on for a very, very long time. And it's not just about trade, right? It's also partly about mechanization. There were 30,000 people who used to work for Borders Books. Today, there are zero people working for Borders Books. And so my point would simply be, if we want to look towards the future, we are going to say to 40% of the world's economy, we want to export to you. Because American workers on a level playing field will outcompete any worker on the planet, and we want to export to you. The way to do that, of course, is to engage, not to say we're going to throw up trade barriers. I understand the concerns, and I've listened to them for a year and a half about trade agreements possibly contributing to the elimination of jobs. It's actually not trade agreements. It's globalization. Trade agreements say to Malaysia and Vietnam and other countries in the region, if you're going to trade with us, if you want access to our markets, you're going to behave environmentally with respect to labor rights and other things. And that's why, again, hey, look, let's not prejudge the TPP. Nobody has seen it. But under the TPA, all of America will get to see it for 2 months before the president even signs it, at which point, John, we can have a much more informed conversation because we'll all be looking at the text. But my point in voting for TPA was simply, let's get a look at it and consider it before, you know, before just slamming the door on it.
I need to take a break and get to some more questions about this. I just have to ask you quickly, you use the example of, say, U.S. auto jobs going overseas to China. I think what a lot of people in labor unions are seeing is the results of the NAFTA trade agreement, those jobs going not to China, but those jobs going to Mexico. And my car was built in Mexico. A lot of people's were there. I think that there is a feeling that in America, certainly amongst the labor unions, that this opens up another door, another possibility for American jobs, which, as you have rightly said, are higher paying and also very efficient, to find someplace where they can be done much more cheaply, much more efficiently for the corporations, and again, leech them out of places like Bridgeport.
Yeah, but John, that door has been wide open for 40 years now. And so the idea that just because we now have an agreement with Vietnam, that some business owner in Ohio is going to wake up and say, hey, look, you know, even though I've been able to do this in Mexico or in China or elsewhere in Central America for the last 40 years, now because Vietnam is a part of this and because Vietnam has lower wage rates, now after 40 years of being able to do this otherwise, I'm going to do that. I think that's A, not logical, and B, remember, here's a key fact we haven't even brought up. In the last 5 years, we've seen a net inflow into this country of 800,000 manufacturing jobs. Manufacturing jobs have actually begun to increase because businesses have realized that, boy, you move your plant to Honduras, you've got problems you never imagined you had, much less productive workers, violence, untrained workers. And so we're actually seeing a net inflow of manufacturing jobs in the last 5 years, and that's something that we ought to be working hard to try to accelerate.
We're talking with Jim Himes, who represents Connecticut's 4th Congressional District. He joins us from Fairfield at WSHU today. When we come back, more questions from you at 860-275-7266 about the trade deal. We're also going to be talking about intelligence and foreign policy. You can always join us on Facebook and Twitter. It's at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking with Jim Himes, who represents Connecticut's 4th Congressional District. We're talking about trans-Pacific trade and other issues important to Connecticut residents. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We have a call here from Stephen in Windham. Hi, Stephen. Go ahead. You're on with Congressman Himes.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Jim, I support you in a star chamber. That's a little kooky for me, but I think people of Connecticut, well, you know, they, like Jim, John was saying, NAFTA, like people got burned. And I support you. I believe in organization. And I believe in getting us out there. But people in Connecticut want to know, are you going to burn them?
And so his question, a lot of other people are asking us this question, is who are the winners and losers? Does anyone in Connecticut get burned by a trade deal like this, Jim Himes?
Yeah, look, this is a complicated topic. Trade deals are complicated, and the economics of trade are complicated. Most economists will tell you that if you trade more in the aggregate, everybody does better. And I think most people would acknowledge that that's true. The problem, of course, is that when you trade, the better is unevenly distributed. And oh, by the way, NAFTA, and I think the president would say this and does say this, NAFTA was far from a perfect trade agreement. I'll give you an example. These environmental regulations that we were talking about and labor standards. In NAFTA, the agreement with Mexico and Canada was you'll simply enforce your own law. Now, first of all, Mexican environmental and labor law wasn't particularly strong. And secondly, of course, you've got the issue of enforcement in a place like Mexico. In the TPP, it's very different. It doesn't say you enforce your own law. It says you will agree to the following objective standards in labor and environmental regulations. So as the president says, and people will get a look at this, TPP is actually an opportunity to go back and fix some of the ugly aspects of NAFTA. And I don't want to sit here and defend NAFTA. Now, by the way, the question was, who clearly benefits or who gets hurt in these trade agreements? You know, we haven't talked about the fact that our truly globally competitive industries, that is to say, software, pharmaceuticals, insurance, banking, the service industries, they do remarkably well when they can expand their markets abroad. And of course, this is partly what leads to this notion that the quote unquote corporations do well and working people don't. And there has over time, unquestionably in the last 50 years, been a hollowing out of our manufacturing core. Again, that doesn't necessarily relate to trade agreements per se. It relates to the fact that, you know, companies have upped and moved seeking lower wage rates. Sadly, those jobs are not coming back. I wish they were. But, you know, bending a piece of metal is never going to be done more competitively. And by bending a piece of metal, I mean low value added work where you're not, you know, doing something with a computer driven lathe or something that requires training and skill. The U.S. is just not over time going to be competitive with lower wage countries. However, on the higher end, stuff that does require training and skills and machines and automation, we are going to kick butt on those kinds of jobs. And so long as the TPP – and again, let's be clear here. We got to see what the TPP says in the final analysis. So long as the TPP is good in requiring other countries to drop their barriers to those products that we make, we ought to at least be taking a look at it.
A couple things in what you just said. This idea that the American workforce is competitive because – we have more skilled laborers, because we have higher labor standards, because we have higher environmental standards. This all seems, just true. It seems obviously true. One question that I think a lot of people might have is, as we negotiate higher labor standards for some of these countries which currently don't have them, as we negotiate better environmental standards for countries that currently don't have them, it seems clear that we do open up markets with higher paid workers in those places to buy our products. It also seems like we're making their workers more attractive. We're making the ability to do business overseas with foreign workers much more attractive because we're raising up their overall standards closer, I would think, to what we have. And I'm sure you've heard that concern as well.
Yeah, but that's a good thing, John. It's a good thing in the sense that, and again, well,
and obviously, from a global perspective, it is, you know, completely a good thing. I just want to get that out there. But that is certainly one of the concerns that you hear from people who are worried about protecting U.S. jobs.
Yeah, but I think it's an unadulteratedly good thing in the sense that, you know, done right, this trade agreement could shut down sweatshops in Vietnam, you know, get 12-year-olds out of, you know, factories and raise standards. That's a good thing in the aggregate. And by the way, if in fact foreign workers are now being provided, you know, a safer workplace, if they're being provided the kinds of benefits that our workers become less relatively uncompetitive, another way of saying more competitive, and you know, don't have that wage differential. One other point I want to make here, John, is what we need to focus on, in addition to just what an hour of labor costs, we need to focus on the value of those things that surround an American worker that actually make them more competitive, that also cost money. I mean, for example, let me give you an example. A high turnover business where a business needs to constantly recruit new employees, you know, call centers are typical, have huge turnover. That's not a good thing, right? So a business where workers are trained, where they're given discretion and the ability to feel like their job is fulfilling, where they're given good benefits, where they're given training opportunities, all that stuff is expensive. But there's a huge payback on that stuff because it means that workers turn over less. They feel more valued and more at home in their job. So we shouldn't fall into the trap of thinking that, you know, what a business wants is the cheapest possible labor, because if it's just about what you're paying an individual by the hour, there are hidden costs to that make us actually more competitive than we might otherwise think we were.
Let's go to a call from Moti, who's calling from New Haven. Hello there. You're on Where We Live.
Good morning. I have a question for the Senate, Congressman. I am a manufacturer based in New Haven. We went through NAFTA. We went through the after 2001 attacks, through Pakistan getting the most favored nation status, and I saw, I'm a textile manufacturer, and I saw my industry being decimated. For the first time in 20 years, we're seeing jobs coming back to this country and work coming back to this country. I see restoring them. I'm experiencing it right now. How is this going to help me? How is this going to even the playing field? It's happening naturally. Why do I have to believe that something like this is going to, you know, TPP is going to help me?
And Moti, thank you for the question. Just to ask you quickly, you say you're in the textiles business?
Yes. We're one of the last companies that do what we do in Connecticut and in the U.S., frankly. We make textiles here.
Okay. Thank you very much for your call. Congressman Himes?
Yeah, so I kind of have to answer the question in general because I just don't know Modi's business in specific. You know, some of our, you know, lower end textile businesses that have been badly hurt over the last couple of decades. You know, you had a big textile industry down in kind of North Carolina, Virginia, that area. On the flip side, some of our higher end, more designed textiles, you know, the athletic fabrics that you you see branded, have done very, very well. But the answer to the question is, as we lower barriers to our exports in 40% of global GDP, as Japan begins to admit more of our exported automobiles, those automobiles, some of the upholstery is fabric. That would be an opportunity for Modi. I don't know exactly what his business is, but for a textile business to actually be a subcontractor to our export industries. And so those tariffs, though people say this is really not about reducing trade barriers, it is a big piece about there is a big piece of it about reducing trade barriers. You know, for example, cosmetics into Malaysia and Vietnam suffer 35% tariffs. When those go away, small businesses and large businesses will have an opportunity to really increase their sales into what is almost half of the global market out there.
Moti, I don't know if you're still there.
I'm here. Yep.
Could you just quickly give us, if you don't mind, a few details on your business just so that we have a little bit more clarity?
So I'm a high-end manufacturer of coated fabric. We actually are a Tier 1 supplier to the automotive industry. We supply them already. We supply high-end industrial safety suits to various Fortune 500 companies. But also, we also supply low-end stuff. We make, you know, vinyl products for beanbag industry and, you know, like really low-end stuff that you see in Walmart and Target. We survive because we're a family-owned business, and we used to be much larger than we are today, but every time one of these trade deals came through, we got beaten down, and we lost market share. And it was always better. We were always told this is going to be better for you. They're going to open up new markets. It never, ever worked. I saw NAFTA, immediately after NAFTA, we had customers in the furniture industry that were based in the Tijuana, just north of Tijuana. Everything went over to Mexico.
But one of the things, Moti, very quickly, I'm interested in this, and while the congressman is on the line here, one of the points that he is making is if we open up this market to just millions and millions and millions of new consumers, people who are going to be buying American cars in Japan, it's potentially something that's quite different than what we've had in the past. This is the fastest growing part of the world. This is a market that we've not been open to previously. Do you see this, Moti, as something that could be different than what we've seen in the past?
Let me shock you. I export to China right now. I have container loads going of my materials to China on a regular basis. You want to know why? Not because I'm the cheapest, because I'm the best. Mm. And I supply high-end quality product. Think about it. I'm exporting to China container loads a month. And it's not because they put out a junky product. It's because we're the highest end in what we do.
Thank you very much for that. I appreciate you giving us some more detail because I think that helps flesh out our conversation a little bit. I have to get to break in a moment. But Jim Himes, can you just explain a little bit about China's role in all of this? I mean, at the end of the day, one of the things that we hear is that America needs to negotiate this deal with these 11 countries in part because we don't want China writing the regulations around trade for the Pacific region. We should be. So what do you see as China's role in all this as we hear our caller talking about right now exporting stuff to China because his products is the best?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I hope we have an opportunity at some point. Modi said something very, very important. He exports because he does very high value added, high tech stuff. And that's the key. And by the way, John, that points to a discussion about education and how we foster innovation in this country. It's really the future of the country. At some point, it would be great to unpack that because that's really what lies in the future for the country. And that has huge implications for us. But, you know, with respect to China, yes, there's an argument there, too. China is not part of the TPP. If we walk away from this and it falls apart, look, you just need to pick up the newspaper to see what China's doing in the South China Sea in terms of setting up a kind of world bank that we're excluded from. They are looking to set the terms of trade in this region in a way that is not good for us. You know, they sort of see us as somebody who ought to be present a lot less than we are in their backyard. And so and you don't have to be a genius to know that if, you know, China gets to set, you know, environmental regulations in the region or labor rights in the region, that's probably not going to be as good an outcome for many of the people in these countries than if we do it together.
We of course, also see right now, you know, China's stock market is having an enormous problem. I mean, at the end of the day, China is seen as this enormous powerhouse that we have to compete with for jobs and customers. But they seem to be going through a massive restructuring, a problem that we faced a few years ago, maybe looming for China.
Absolutely. Look, China has problems that we would not want to have. I mean, everybody thinks they're the, you know, big guy on the block and they're the future and everything. Look, politically and economically, they have huge problems. And they're also, by the way, just to get back to Modi's point, which is so important, yes, they can produce the cheapest stuff in the world. He used the word junkie, cheaper than anybody else. But they don't begin to have the innovative capacity that the United States has. You know, they may be making, and I wish they weren't, but they may be making iPhones in Shenzhen, but they're sure not inventing them there. And again, this points to something we need to talk more about, which is how can we keep that competitive advantage that this country unquestionably has of our innovative capacity, our ability to invent the products of tomorrow? How can we make that more than what it is today? Because China, Japan, Asia, no one else has it.
We're talking with Jim Himes, who represents Connecticut's 4th Congressional District. When we come back, we're going to be talking about some more foreign policy issues, also find out what he thinks the impact of the problems that are happening in Greece right now or the problems in Puerto Rico are having on the U.S. economy. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today in the program, we're talking with Jim Himes, who represents Connecticut's 4th Congressional District. He joins us today from the studios of our friends at WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. We've been talking a lot about trade in the program, but there's a lot more to talk about that's on Jim Himes' plate right now. Congressman, what effect, if any, do you think that the current Greek financial crisis will have on the U.S. economy?
Well, very much a real-time question, as we saw the plebiscite happen in Greece yesterday. You know, bottom line, if the EU begins to fray, the European Economic Community begins to fray, and if that puts downward pressure on the economies of Europe, it is going to have a pretty significant echo in the United States economy, right? We export back to trade. We can't escape it.
Sure.
We export an awful lot. We have an awful lot of economic relationships with Europe. And so that if – and by the way, it's a big if. Look, let's remember, Greece in and of itself is actually not terribly important to the United States economy. If the fraying of the EU were really to put downward pressure on the region as a whole, we could feel that. And so, you know, fingers crossed that they can manage this. However it plays out, whether Greece stays in or leaves the union, we want it obviously to play out in a way that does not damage the economies of the continent as a whole.
But what do we do about it? I mean, what should the United States do in helping to assure that there's a strong European Union, a strong financial system in our most important trade partner?
Yeah, well, you know, we're not at the table on this thing, right? This is a European Union issue, and it floats a really important question for Europe, which is, does it make sense to have a single currency in a region that has economies as different as the German economy, which is this unbelievable powerhouse where people save and are hugely productive, and in Greece, which is a radically different economy where productivity is much lower and it is far from a powerhouse economy. And it poses all sorts of economic issues. What should the U.S. do? Look, I suspect the United States Treasury Secretary and other senior economic people are urging Germany and urging Europe and trying to be as helpful as they can in controlling this thing. Again, the answer is uncertain. Does Greece stay in or leave the union is a very uncertain question. The key is, of course, that it happen, whatever happens, that it happen in a you know, sane way. You know, there was an article, I think it was yesterday, Iceland is another small country on the periphery of Europe that found itself in a world of hurt after 2008. And they actually imposed some capital controls and did some things that are, you know, pretty unorthodox economically and got their house in order. So I think the best role the U.S. can be playing right now is to be urging everybody to step back and make sure that whatever happens, it happens in a way that doesn't affect the broader European economy negatively.
Speaking of something a little bit closer to home, we've been learning for years about the financial trouble that Puerto Rico has been having, and that's become even more stark in just the last few weeks. Very high unemployment there. What do you think the United States should do to help Puerto Rico? This, of course, is so very important to so many people here in Connecticut, where there is a large number of Puerto Rican Americans living here and transitioning back and forth constantly between here and the island.
Yeah, you know, and Puerto Rico, this is really interesting. Puerto Rico, at its core, raises the same issue that is raised by Greece, right? You have two countries that, let me use the word, borrowed irresponsibly. And yes, when someone borrows irresponsibly, there's a lender on the other side who lent irresponsibly. But you have an untenable situation. So we know that the debts of Puerto Rico and of Greece are going to be renegotiated. And it's important, and this is really the key issue, it's important that they be renegotiated in a way that allows the countries to actually grow their way out of the situation that they find themselves are in, hopefully doing the kinds of reforms that assure everybody, including the citizens of those countries or commonwealths in the case of Puerto Rico, that they don't get back into that situation, but that are not so austere and so brutal that they create a recession that digs the hole even deeper. That's the key. And by the way, a lot of the tension back and forth you're going to hear that you hear with respect to Greece and with Puerto Rico comes down to one thing, which is how much of a haircut are the lenders into Greece and Puerto Rico going to take in the renegotiation? Of course, the banks and Wall Street and the creditors and whatever hedge funds happen to own pieces of Greek debt or Puerto Rican debt are going to argue for a more severe regime that gets more of their money back, which may feel good to them, but if they overdo that, of course, it's going to make it very difficult for these two places to dig their way out, to ultimately have economies that grow again and allow them to service this restructured debt.
The only difference, of course, is that Puerto Rico, I mean, they are us. This is a United States problem. Many people in Puerto Rico say that the United States has not allowed them to act fully in the global marketplace. The problems that they're having aren't their own problems. They're problems of the United States government and its oversight of this territory.
I don't accept that. You know, untenable budget and debt situation that that Puerto Rico finds itself in is not a product of the United States of America. It's the product of decisions, frankly, that the Puerto Rican government made over time. And the fact that it's got something of a creaky economy. That said, look, at the end of the day, it's not a question of blame. The question is, how do we restructure? And this is what, you know, you're going to hear the Title IX meme thrown around quite a bit. Title IX is a way to renegotiate your debts. Bottom line is Puerto Rico's debts are going to be renegotiated. And the question is, who feels how much pain? The bondholders, the lenders to Puerto Rico are going to feel pain, as are, you know, the Puerto Ricans, because it's tough to get out of a situation like this. But the point is, we can't allow a renegotiated, restructured debt that is essentially punitive in a way that forbids, if you will, the Puerto Rican economy from growing going forward. You know, it's a little bit like what we struggled with in 2009, right? We had a huge budget deficit, no question, $1.5 trillion budget deficit in 2010. And a lot of people were saying, you know, we've got to slash the budget in order to do away with this deficit. That, of course, would have been exactly the wrong thing to do as the economy was in what we now call the Great Recession. So it's a balancing act, you know, restructure, but don't do it in a way so severe that the economy is stunted for years to come.
Last week, leading up to the 4th of July holiday, there were reports about increased security risks. You're on the Intelligence Committee and you have access to a lot of information and data around some of these threats. What can you tell us about what we knew about threats moving into the holiday and whether or not we are at some greater risk as a nation than we have been in recent years?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a complicated story. There was a lot of chatter, and this made it out into the news. There was a lot of chatter that suggested that there were individuals out there affiliated with ISIS and others who wanted to make a splash around the 4th of July, which happened to occur during the Ramadan season. Thank God nothing happened. But you take, of course, that kind of chatter very seriously. Stepping back from this, John, what you see is a world where – thanks to the very good work of our intelligence community and our military, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, all these groups who would wish us ill are so back on their heels with respect to our going after their leadership that we find that it's very difficult, if not impossible, for them to organize a big structured attack like 9/11, you know, major event that requires a lot of organization. What is the threat, of course, is what we're seeing around the world right now, which is the proverbial lone wolf. You know, the individual who gets radicalized online, like this guy, you know, these guys down in Texas or a couple of examples in Europe. And they may not be trained, which is a good thing from the standpoint of stopping them. They may not have spent time in a terrorist camp, but if they can get their hands on a couple of weapons or something, they can cause havoc. And that's a much harder thing to track down for our intelligence and law enforcement people.
In just the last couple of minutes that we have, I'm wondering – how much of the work of the intelligence community is focused on domestic terrorism. We've had conversations on our program in the wake of the Charleston shootings about an undercurrent of white supremacy and terrorism aimed at African Americans and other groups within the United States as something that is very real and something that is at least as important as watching these groups that you mentioned overseas. Can you talk about how much of the intelligence community's time and effort is actually aimed at taking a look at people who are inside our borders and are not affiliated with any Muslim extremist group, but are indeed acting for very different reasons?
Yeah, and the answer to that is pretty clear, which is that the intelligence community per se, the CIA, the NSA, the Department of Defense, are oriented outside our borders. And that's actually a good thing, right? Core to our sense of ourselves as Americans is that our intelligence services and our military don't operate within our borders, and the FBI and law enforcement do that. The good news is, of course, that they coordinate technologies. You know, they've got very smart people who know how to eavesdrop in all of those organizations, and they do coordinate technologies. But again, you know, the intelligence community per se is really focused at threats outside our borders. Organizations like the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security look inward. And yes, we have been so focused on the fight against, you know, we equate the fight against terrorism in our minds with the fight against Muslim extremism, because that has been the form that this has taken. But as the report showed last week, we have actually lost an awful lot more Americans. I think the number was twice as many Americans to internal extremist, right-wing, you know, white supremacist, whatever flavor you want to conjure. We've actually lost a lot more Americans to that kind of terrorism than we have to the Muslim extremist terrorism that we tend to think of when we hear the word terrorism.
And I guess, why haven't we then adjusted the balance properly? I mean, I know that the NSA is meant to look outwards, but as I think we all well know, they are indeed spying domestically on a regular basis. I mean, could not some of this effort be addressing the very real concerns that we have, that more people die at the hands of domestic terrorism than those from the outside?
Yeah, you want to be a little careful about that, John, for a couple of reasons. One, long conversation, but no, the NSA and the CIA are spying abroad. Now, yes, the NSA does pick up in a program that, thank God, is going away, you know, the metadata associated with U.S. people, persons' phone calls. But anyway, you don't want the NSA and the Department of Defense focused internally. And secondly, look, this kid who committed this atrocity in Colombia, you know, yes, he'd been, you know, active on, like a lot of disenchanted, you know, idiotic kids are, on, you know, a number of websites and whatnot. But, you know, the NSA and CIA are not really configured to follow a kid like that. And you know, we really want the FBI doing that. But the question that we don't have time to address, which is a profoundly important question, John, is, you know, we have reordered our society starting after 9/11 with respect to our civil liberties, with respect to the literally trillions of dollars we have spent at war in the Middle East, Afghanistan and Iraq. Not to mention the thousands of young Americans that we've lost in the conflicts over there, which were fought as part of the global war on terror. We have utterly reordered our society around the fight against Muslim extremism without really thinking about, is this the right number? Is this the right level of resources to apply against a problem that, as you point out, may not be as much of a problem as the internally generated stuff?
It is indeed a much longer conversation for another day. Jim Himes, it's always good to talk through a lot of these issues with you, and I really appreciate you joining us today.
Thanks a lot, John. I appreciate it.
Jim Himes represents Connecticut's 4th Congressional District. He joins us today from the studios of WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. I want to thank them for their help with today's program. Thanks also to Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, Lydia Brown, Kyone Wolf, Heather Brandon, Katie Tlarski, the team that puts together Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us.